welcome to We're All Gonna Die and Other Fun Facts, a semi-regular, occasionally amusing, and rarely funny series of conversations on a random topic. This episode is entitled Improv, Improve, E in parentheses. And it's sort of about doing things on the fly. And I guess didn't we kind of steal that joke from Mitch Hedberg or something?
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, yes. And so our guest for this episode is a man who knows a little something about improvisation, Mr. Spiff Wiegand, who was our first guest.
And your first ghost.
And a first ghost, because you're now the first repeat guest.
Yeah, I'm like the ghost, the specter of the first
specter
podcast.
Of the podcast, yeah. The specter of the demo version. Yes. And so it is good to see you again. It's good to see you. Being on our podcast did not totally ruin your career as a performer.
It did not. It did not ruin it. And I'm not sure it did anything for it either.
it probably did not.
But you know, it was still fun to do. I loved doing that first podcast. It was really fun.
Yes, and thank you. And you were the best, I think, first guest ever, cuz you're just, "Okay, let's do this." Cuz you know, there's this moment where okay, best example I can think of, it was on the UK Top Gear. There's a guy who basically put, like, a French guy, he has what is essentially a tabletop. Mm-hmm. Like, he made wings out of a tabletop and then strapped two small jet engines to his back.
Okay.
And will fly. Like, he's like the human jet. And Richard Hammond, the one host, said, you know, because they had the guy on, and then the clip was over, or the story was over, and he was like, you know, you got to think about it, though. Like, there's not a whole lot of learning curve with that. No. Like, you put the jet engines on your back and what is essentially what looks like a tabletop, you know, but fancified. There's eventually just the day that you have to go do it.
Yeah.
Like, you can do some wind tunnel shit and you can kind of, like, do some math. But eventually it's like, no, I'm going to jump out of a helicopter. Yeah.
You'd think you'd use a dog first or something. But
yeah, that would probably be wrong.
That would probably be wrong.
But you know what I mean? Yeah. And it's just like, wow, okay, well, today's the day we're going to do this. And so I thought about the podcast for about a month, and then you were here, and you were like, okay, let's do this.
Yeah.
And I was like, and that moment of, like, stepping over the edge or jumping out of the helicopter, you're like, okay, let's make something happen.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, okay.
I think I remember when I was in college and there was, you know, learning music, and there was always... people would be really timid with their musical ideas because we were learning, but I remember this concept of, like, you do not know where the line is until you cross it. Like, you have to be absolutely too loud, way louder than you thought you should be, in order to go, oh no, I have to pull that back a little bit for the effect I want. Like, you kind of have to cross the line. You have to jump in.
Yeah,
you know, your feet wet. You know.
That's right. You know, there's this amazing Tobias Wolff story now called The Liar. And it's really stuck with me. And I forgot the plot. I totally spaced on the plot of this story, but there's this great line where a man it's about a young man, and I think it's young man, father issues, and he's talking to a friend of his father. And there's this great line about, you know, the thing with your father is your father was a very brilliant guy, but he never pushed himself.
Mm.
Because he figured that if he never pushed himself, he would never find out where that limit was.
Yeah.
And therefore, he could live the rest of his life thinking that he was limitless.
Right.
And that's one of those things that I was always like, well, damn.
Yeah.
Moments like, oh, that explains a lot of fucking people.
Yeah. Explains me at some points in my life. Like, I think in my 20s I was a dreamer. In my 30s, I was a doer. That doesn't mean I'm still not a dreamer, and I don't... Like, I think of all kinds of things that I should do and I never do. And I love living in that world for myself. That's a great brain space for me and something that comes up a lot.
Yeah.
But the doing has started to happen for me.
Yeah.
And, but the dreaming element was such a great space to be in. Like, all the things I could do. And when you're in your 20s, for better or for worse, I feel like you're in this place where you're like, life is going to last forever. And in your 30s, you sort of stop thinking that way.
Yeah. I'm halfway to 70.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, you're like, it's time to do some things, and I can't wait to do them now.
Do you think it's also a matter of being more comfortable in your own skin?
Surely.
Douglas Copeland. Why am I quoting shit today? Because I'm an English professor. That's why I quote shit. Douglas Copeland has this great line in the Souvenir of Canada documentary where he says, you know, I just had an awful 20s. Uh-huh. And everybody I know, and I think everybody I know, and I can say that too now that I'm halfway to 70, everybody I know who's doing really interesting, cool shit, I think had an awful 20s.
Mm.
And it's something I always tell my students. If you want to do something with your life, your 20s are going to be fucking terrible.
Yeah, because you're really trying to figure it out. It's
and difficult. You're really trying to figure out, and you're going through what a painter friend of mine, Chuck Olson, calls the hell stage, where you're trying shit and it just doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's something that happens when you cross that mental 30 barrier where it's like, oh yeah, I've been doing this shit for a while now,
right?
And you're like, you had a decade of adult self.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of like, okay, I know how the machine works now. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
it's true.
I read the owner's manual. Wow, it can. You know, I think that's really important. I think, or it was for me.
I think it was important for me too. Yeah, like, I got a kind of a late start on making my art. So, I think that artistically I'm in my 20s, but mentally I'm in my 30s.
Mm.
So I'm trying things that may or may not work. I'm not worried about it. which is pretty nice.
Which I think that's the other thing is after you get to that age, it's just sort of like, well, fuck it.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? You just get to that. There's that angst of youth.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, what is she going to think of me? Am I going to fit in? How do I fit in the world? And by the time you get to be 30, it's like, oh, fuck it. You know?
Yeah.
It's just like, you know, I'm not at the, you know, socks with sandals stage of fuck it yet, you know, and hopefully I'll never get there. Hopefully socks with sandals, that is, you know, there's a lovely city of bridges that we live in, I live in anyway, and there's just, I can jump, which reminds me, we were down at the point at 5 o'clock yesterday.
Yes, we were.
At 5:05, somebody jumped from the Clemente Bridge, like really, really close to where we were.
And we missed it?
And we missed that.
I mean, I hope... Was he okay?
He was okay. He's in the hospital.
Did he jump trying to commit suicide, or did he jump trying to do a stunt?
Probably the first one. But paper wasn't real detailed, but...
Well, I'm sorry that he did it, but if he was going to do it and I couldn't have done anything about it, I would have liked to have...
Yeah, we would have been on the other side of the river, man.
Admittedly.
But that was, like, really close to where we were yesterday. Okay. But, you know, like, if I ever get socks with sandals, that's time. It's time. Mm-hmm. You know, like, that's total fuck it. Like, you know,
time to jump on the bridge.
You know, it's sort of like my dad once had a pair of jeans, and I guess, I don't know, he had some jockish issues.
Okay.
And so there was a spot. There was a spot, right?
On where he was scratching through his jeans?
Where the blue had worn off. And so there was a white spot that was perfectly, now that I think about it, testicle shaped. And my mom had to cut that. She didn't just throw them away. She had to cut them up to the point of being unwearable so that they could disappear. Because my dad did not give a fuck.
Right.
Like,
right.
You know, then that was just his whole, and the whole time I knew him, you know, was just this guy who did not give a fuck. And I wonder, you know, now looking back, did he in his 20s have this sort of awkward, you know, right, oh, is she gonna like me? Kind of phase where it's like the internal monologue. Do these people think I'm cool?
And then by the time you knew him, he was just fuck it.
I'm gonna mow the lawn in my swim trunks because that's what's clean. You know what I mean?
Right.
And I think there's something so liberating about being 30 or whatever, and just that's over.
Yeah.
That voice has shut the fuck up.
Yeah. Yeah. For the most part, that is completely true.
Like, and
it feels nice.
Then make things happen and do stuff.
Yeah. Which is what that idea of improv/improve is kind of.
Yeah. Oh, it's now slash now.
I see. Well, I put it's, you know, I don't know how to say it. It's a visual joke more than anything.
But, yes, which is good for a podcast.
Yeah, it's great for a podcast. The thing that I started doing with this improv song of the day, which is in its infancy, it's only 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Has been, it's really about improv, but with an idea of improving my songwriting skills, because you have to be in the moment and dealing with the process and just kind of saying what you think and not editing yourself too much. But at the same time, you are editing yourself because you're kind of like, I guess I'm improvising a song. If I called it improvised music of the day, it could really be a free for all. I'm finding that I'm losing the product more and more, though in fact I know it's there.
Mm-hmm.
But because I'm improvising and then immediately posting it, I can't edit. I can't go back. And sometimes I catch myself trying to, and that's when I have to switch gears entirely and throw away what I was quote unquote improvising and come back and just truly improvise something. But the experience has been fantastic. It's been really cool.
Yeah. And that's available where
I have a SoundCloud page.
It's what soundcloud.com/
Spifftunes.
Backsplash. It's in the kitchen behind the sink. Spifftunes.
And I'll have the link,
of course, on our website as always.
And I should it'll be on my Spiff Weekend website and spifftunes.com. Yeah. It should be all. Yeah. You'll see it like on the page. Yeah.
And so there's a phrase that my uncle, who's was a youth hockey coach when my cousin played, and they were up like by 10 goals against the team, and they have something called the mercy rule where they don't stop the clock no matter what.
Mm.
They're just like, okay, let's get these kids over with, or let's get these kids out of here.
Yeah.
And he said, well, I told my players, think of it as a hard practice.
Mm.
You know, there really is another team there. This game really does count, but it's over.
Yeah.
And I think about like that kind of concept as, so it's practice, but there's still a product, but there's still,
mm-hmm.
you know, so I guess what comes of the improve exercise?
Mm-hmm.
Is it eventually then going to be something you're going to go back and say, well, of these, what, you're up to what, song 15 now?
Yeah, 16 as of yesterday.
I still have to do my 17. Are you then going to go back and say, well, okay, now this one is going to get into the routine at some point? Or is this far as it goes? Or
I guess I'm open to anything. The nice part is that I really can, I can try ideas like that. I can try like making a best of compilation. I could try to go back and write some of them. I could ask for fan input about what their favorite one is. Mm-hmm. or what I've it's even crossed my mind to I would love to try to do it live in front of people as part of my show, which I mean, assuming the fans would be interested, then I would be interested in being able to do it live. I feel like I would go back to step one with them being really difficult at first, you know, but anyway, that process is open and interesting to me. But the cool thing about focusing on the process, this is something I'm thinking a lot about these days. And part of what spurred me to just start this improv song of the day thing that I'd been thinking of for a while. I decided to just jump in because I found myself thinking of the product too much. So now that I'm just doing something, I'm just improvising, I'm allowing myself to do it. The product is still interesting to me, but I don't have a final result in mind.
Mm.
So it's really sweet to say, to be surprised by a product instead of working towards a specific intention.
I understand. So there's almost maybe a spirit of play with it then.
Oh, yeah. It's really funny and fun. Sometimes.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Because I'm thinking about a couple of things that what you just said reminded me of. There's in American Hardcore, the documentary about 80s kind of American post-punk, that whole scene. I forgot who it was in that documentary said how utterly liberating it was for them that there was no expectation that this would ever get on the radio or anybody would ever really buy it or care about it except for the group of 10 people that they knew immediately.
Yeah.
And there was a total creative freedom.
Yeah.
That those bands had because there was no expectation.
That is exactly what I'm feeling these days, because I pushed expectation and product on myself for a long time because I have songs I want people to hear, and now I'm
a record out.
Yeah, and all that stuff.
Recording. And did you also record, you were going to record an album that was both the CD and a DVD? Was that a thought or a plan?
So that album is done. It just hasn't, it's been recorded.
Okay.
But it's live takes on camera. So the audio is single takes of me performing as a one-man band, but then there's video of me making that take. I'm not sure if you'll be able to download the video. Probably you can download the video or something.
Yeah.
But basically, people will probably watch it on YouTube, and then if they want to buy the album, they can, the audio. I used to think about the product so much, and I would approach, okay, I've got these songs. Now what I want is a whole bunch of people to show up at my gig, and now what I want is everyone to buy my record. And you do that for a while, and then you just get frustrated because, I don't know, how do you get a whole bunch of people to buy your record?
Does anybody get to do that nowadays? Yeah.
And so, like, you know, it used to be, you know, get a record deal. Now it's like, you can do it if you're really energetic, indie artists, like if you, and there's people that have had success with that. But for me, I'm back to the point of like, you know what? Yeah, I have 10 people following me on any given social media, and then I also have 10 people show up at my gigs. I feel like I can guarantee 10.
Yeah.
So I'm really happy with what I'm doing musically, so if I don't think about the product, if I just continue to enjoy myself, maybe I'll never get more than 10, but at least I'll enjoy myself. And then maybe I'll get 100,000 people. But as long as I'm still enjoying myself, it's, you know, like, I had to... So I'm trying to really lose the product and make the unintended product be a fun thing to experience and focus on the process as something that I need to be enjoyable for myself.
Yeah. Now, that makes a tremendous amount of sense. And you think about, maybe is it this way that whatever it is you do, or whether you want to call that professionalization, you know, that moment of, oh shit, this is serious now.
Yeah.
This is what I do to do a thing.
Yeah.
That degree of seriousness, if you're a creative person or you're doing something creative, that where that line of seriousness comes in, and is it still then possibly fun and playful and interesting? Or does it become, you know, Jacques Attali, an English professor, I'm doing it again.
That's all right.
Annoys the political economy of music, says, you know, there's Carnival. He said, you know, his whole theory in that book is that music is the legitimate use of violence in a state or in a culture. That all music, the difference between noise and music really is both are really violent. In a way, but music, what goes from noise, the state of noise, to the state of music, is that it becomes legitimized or familiar through repetition.
Right.
He was a big Freudian pleasure principle kind of guy.
Uh-huh.
And so what he says, though,
I'm more
is
of a
that,
Janet Jackson pleasure principle kind of guy.
Oh, thank you.
Stupid. Good night. Anyway, continue.
Yes. Is that then you have... What then happens, shit gets repeated so much that what might be spontaneous, joyous, crazy, new moment, or what he calls like Carnival or the Feast of Fools before Lent, when anything's possible,
right,
to then becoming Lent, the solemn procession.
Uh-huh.
And so, and you look at like things that get played out or things that become popular, you know. You think the entire 1990s was dominated by Pearl Jam 10.
Mm-hmm.
And Pearl Jam wasn't even playing that record anymore. They weren't making that record anymore. But everybody else was.
Right.
And there's a station here in Pittsburgh that if, you know, we were to turn on the stereo or go out to my car and pull it up, that you would hear that sound. Right. You would hear that 1995 sound almost 20 years later, and it is, that is the sound, and that is the only sound.
Yeah. It does. It comes. It's kind of like that. I like their first album kind of thing, where you're like, I don't know. Then they just got. I got tired of it.
They kept doing it. Yeah.
And I wonder. I sometimes wonder if the bands get tired of it, and they're. You could probably hear it. It probably. I'm sure it depends on the band, but there's that, like, the band does two or three albums and they have this great sound, and then, yeah, like Pearl Jam or something.
Yeah.
I'm not to say that they aren't doing good stuff. I've never
and,
been.
And
a
they
fan,
walked
actually.
Away from. Yeah. Actually, and they walked away from that sound themselves.
Yeah.
They were like, we don't want to do this shit anymore. Let Creed handle that. You know what I mean? Like, we get the Creed people on
let's
that.
Let's let Creed handle that.
Yes.
That's fun.
You know, which is kind of a different thing. And I think it also then is that matter of that leap of faith, that making the artistic risk, wanting to do something else.
Uh-huh.
Suddenly. And how does that work? Like, mm-hmm. saying, okay, I have this franchise. I have this thing that I figured out.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe people do like it, and it is my profession, or whatever. But, you know, whatever. I gotta play this song every night,
mm-hmm.
and not wanting to maybe go back into the hell stage and trying to figure right. something out, and maybe figure out something that's not immediately perfect.
Yeah.
And I think we live in a cultural moment where how many interactions that we have in our lives, whether with people or the objects around us, that shit always kind of immediately works.
There's that. That's interesting, because I think I've definitely been playing some of the same songs over and over. Like, there's certain songs I play at every gig, and if you play a lot of yeah. gigs, that means you play the song a lot. And even if you, and if the song exists for a while before you begin to perform it, I mean, some of my songs have been in existence for 10, 15 years. Whether I've been performing them or not. And so I might not want to perform them, but it's time to do it.
Yeah.
And but the cool thing is that if I remain in the moment and thinking of, again, thinking about this process thing, it's like the product is the song, but I don't know how the song's going to come out, because I'm a different person that day than I was mm-hmm. when I wrote it. And mm-hmm. I'm a different person than I was the day before, because... Yeah. You know, my car has trouble, I'm thinking about something else. And not only that, the audience is different.
Yeah.
The venue is different. The tuning on my banjo might be slightly off. Or,
mm-hmm.
And it's that focus of detail and process that makes everything more interesting.
Yeah.
Because I already know somewhat what the product's going to be. There's going to be a song that I play and the lyrics go like this.
Mm-hmm.
But there's all of the elements that might change. And those are the fun parts.
Yeah.
And also kind of like, you know, this connection with the audience and the oh, this, I always, there are certain lyrics that I think are going to get a reaction from the audience because I love them, even though I wrote them. Yes, you have to love your own stuff. I know.
Yeah.
It may sound, it's not the kind of thing you should say, maybe, but it's true.
No, you do have to, you know, you're right. You do have to love something. In some way, or have that, I think, connection to it. Whether it is, yeah, is it monstrously egotistical, or it's an old friend, or...
Mm-hmm.
I remember one time when I was acting in college, I was in a play, and I was supposed to... I was supposed to have this romantic interest,
mm-hmm.
and I really hated the human being. I really hated her as a person. She was sort of just this vapid kind of girl who had... this real ugly streak inside of her, and I had seen that ugly streak.
Mm-hmm.
And so we would do the scenes, and it was supposed to be where I was like, hey, Esmeralda, or whatever. And I couldn't do it. I mm-hmm. could not. And it's always, you know, and my director pulled me aside. He says, Matt, you know, you have to A, love your own character,
mm-hmm.
and you have to find something about her that you like.
Yeah.
I settled on the fact that she was 100% biodegradable. Like, when she died, that's totally good compost. And that was what I had to go with. And I'm an ugly human being. But the extreme of that is, I remember they had one of those AFI, American Film Institute things, mm-hmm. you know, top movie villains, Kathy Bates.
And she was great.
And Kathy Bates is Annie Wilkes in Misery.
Yeah.
And she was like, well, you know, Annie, she, you know, she gets a little hand out of hand sometimes, but she's deep down, she's a caring person.
Uh-huh.
And then there was another clip of her saying, well, you know, Annie, you know, she loves what she loves, and she feels passionately about her interests. And then finally, the last clip, when all these other people are like, oh my God, Annie Wilkes was so crazy, that yeah. character in Misery. She finally, the last clip they used of her was saying, you're not going to, try as hard as you will, you're not going to get me to say anything bad about Annie Wilkes.
Right.
And that she, embodying that woman who tortured James Caan to death and shot to death the cool old sheriff guy, she loved that character and loved that human being,
you're
even
right,
though it was monstrous,
you
know? You
have to be really committed to it.
You have to be really...
And nobody... Well, I mean, some people, I guess, hate themselves, but lots of people love themselves, and they don't... Mm-hmm. And they see them... You know, like, they think they're a great driver, they're all that they're...
Yes.
We all do that, and you know, we're all not.
Yes.
But you gotta love yourself. You gotta love yourself somewhat. Even the parts you don't like, you know, you gotta...
Yeah. Which, then, too, is that how do you judge... How do you have your own critical eye about what you're doing? Mm-hmm. Which is, I think, goes back to this big theme of getting away from the product.
Yeah.
And letting the play happen. Like, knowing, oh, this is actually really good, or this is something worth performing again, or worth putting on a record.
There's a wrinkle on that, which I think is important.
Okay.
Is the process of play and thinking about it being good or bad, if you do, in fact, love yourself enough to let yourself make mistakes, then it's going to be more personal of a process, and therefore more personal of a product. And the more personal you get, the better it is every time. In the same way of, like, it reminds me of English Professor. It reminds me of the idea of the universal specific, where which is a, I don't know if that's a term that comes up, but it was presented to me that way as something that, if you talk about the feeling of having, you know, like a hair on your leg get caught in the carpet when you pull it up and it yanks out and then you get a little like bump there and then you scratch it, and then that's so specific that you'd think not everybody has that experience, but it's so specific that everyone can relate to it.
Yes.
And so it becomes this universal idea. So the more I open myself up to the mistakes of being spiff, then and I just, like, you know, let my freak flag fly, then people are, I myself think the product is better, and I'm guessing that people will.
Yeah, and I think it so greatly humanizes it. Mm-hmm. And I sometimes, when I tell to my students, you know, because I have my students sometimes do, like, narrative essays, like, tell your story, and I said, I know this is like turning into the skid, but the more personal you get, and the more detailed you get, the more relatable you become, that you might think the inclination is to go the other way.
Right.
To make it as general as possible and everybody can get this. When, no, it's the real personal. And one of the examples I use is, there is this amazing, 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 amazing band called Marat.
Okay.
Who, the saga of Marat is a whole other podcast. But they, in 2000 or 99 or 2000, they recorded this, maybe one of my top 10 records of all time, called Kids in Philly.
Okay.
And it's their writing about Philadelphia. And at the time, I was living in Philadelphia, and I didn't understand that place at all, and I hated it, and I still kind of hate it. But, you know, I definitely didn't understand it. It was a car horn. I wasn't being censored. saying, like, Philly sucks. And Philly does suck.
Yeah.
But... it was the things that they loved about it, or at least putting the experiences that they had there on an album. And there was this great interview with Dave Belanco in the Philadelphia City Paper. And they were like, do you... And it was on a national label. Like, it was released everywhere, and I think CMJ, the monthly music mag, that was one of the top six best albums that came out that month. And everything. And they're like, well, don't you think that, well, are people going to be able to relate to this if they're not from Philly or they haven't been here? And his answer was so brilliant. He said, well, yeah, not everybody's been to the Golden Donut, but if you're lucky, there's a place in your town that you feel that way about.
Right.
And we think that people will be able to relate to how we feel about the Golden Donut, even if they haven't been to the Golden Donut.
Right. I think that's, yeah, that, that's totally true. And by the way, I lived in Philly at the same time, so now I have to hear this album.
Oh, it's so brilliant. Yeah. Everything that they've done is so brilliant, but there's such a bad luck. Mm-hmm. They had a record on...
How's it, is it M-U-R-A?
M-A-R-A-H. M-A-R-A-H.
Okay.
And it's called Kids in Philly. And they put it, put that record out. People are like, oh, that's cool. And it's this like Philly roots rock, mummers music meets Philly soul.
Nice.
Yeah. So obviously the next thing that they did, speaking of the hell stage and maybe not focusing on product, they flew to England and worked with the guy who released the, who produced one of the first two Oasis albums and did a Britpop album.
Nice.
And completely alienated all of their fans.
I think there's a lot to that because I have, and I know friends, I know my, my other musician friends have this, even if they haven't shared it with me, is that, like, you write in multiple genres, most likely, and there's, and you, you know, you're like, maybe because once the songs are written and you're starting to think about how I'm going to package and and make a product, certain songs don't end up on an album because they don't seem to fit. And for me, I'm always collecting those on the side and hoping that I do...
There's a life for them somewhere else.
And, you know, these days most people don't have outside pressure for their art other than maybe person, you know, not outside pressure. So, you know, like, I can do whatever I want with those songs. And it's nice that Marat was able to, you know, just do what they wanted.
But what happened was... it's still something that the tightly knit community of Marat fans. I mean, whenever they play Pittsburgh, they play this ethnic club on the south side, this Slovenian club called the Kolar Club, and it's it's the same 30 people who always show up at the club, and it's a religious experience for all of us. You know, I mean, it's one of those things. If I talk about that band too much, I get weepy. Like, seriously, I get, like, big, fat, hairy, fat guy weepy, which is just the worst thing in the universe for anybody to witness.
Nice.
But that record still, like, pisses people off that they made it. And Magnet Magazine did an interview with the Blanco brothers a few years later, right before Angels of Destruction came out. And it said, and then they released Kids in Philly, and then they released this Britpop album that had none, and it none of the good qualities of their first record, their first two records. And none was all caps bold. It was typeset in the magazine, all caps bold. None of the great qualities of their first two records. And, like, the, it would be in a magazine... That need, that enunciation, none of the great qualities had to be in there. It was sort of amazing.
Yeah.
That it would make it to a magazine. But then the story was, so they released this other great record called Angels of Destruction, and they played the Conan O'Brien show. And the next day they were supposed to go on a North American European tour. And the bass player and drummer bailed on the band immediately after. And they had apparently had this plan to bail on the band after they played Conan.
That's rough.
And so they had to, like, cancel the tour, and it was... And it's been one tragedy and weirdness and them fucking up and rotating members and this whole hot mess of a train wreck of a band, and they released the worst record they could have ever released at the most crucial time in their lives, and then this happened. And, and when you talk about the... But he's still... They're still doing it. And they're the next record they're going to put out, it's going to be called Mountain Minstrelsy. And it's somebody lent them a book of 19th century Pennsylvania folk lyrics.
Nice.
And there was no music. And so they made music to these lyrics.
That's great.
And it's transcendently beautiful.
It sounds like a band that's really focused on process. And that's, and that it's where, you know, like critics are focused on product. Artists are focused, or should, I think, should be focused on process. So it's like, they're never going to meet. You're going to get somebody saying none in big typeset letters. But, like,
yeah,
I'm like, that guy can eat a dick for all I care. It's like, if he doesn't get the big, he doesn't have to like it. But to, I guess that's why, you just can't count much for critics. Like, I like it when friends tell me positive things about bands they want me to hear. I don't like it when anyone tells me, you know, stay away from that. It's dumb. It's bad. It's not worth your time. It's like, well, maybe it's worth my time. Maybe I'll learn something from it.
Yeah.
It's like, watch it. I was saying to, to Danelle, I think, we were talking about, or maybe you as well, but we were talking about seeing a bad band play. And if you pay attention, I mean, from a, at least from a business standpoint, as a, as another musician, I can learn a lot from watching someone fail, because I, you know, it's like I get a chance to sort of watch someone fail and know what that means. And
yeah, and I really do think in our culture we do have this kind of tyranny of perfection.
Yeah.
That, you know, and again, this is something with my students, because so many of them have to work 20, 30 hours a week, and be students, you know, the stereotype of the lazy beer-drinking student. You know, they are not in, not in the majority anymore in terms of college students. These are people who work their asses off to make ends meet and try to better themselves. I mean, that's the students I deal with. And my Lord, you know, one of the examples of this maybe tyranny of perfection, or maybe how our environment has shifted our perception and our expectations, is if you've ever worked retail and having to ask somebody asking them to wait 5 minutes, or if the cheese fries aren't exactly perfect.
Yeah.
And that's one of those moments as a professor, you know, 20 light bulbs go off and that moment. Yeah, I live that moment 3 times a day.
Yeah.
Where it's immediate red line anger, immediate, like, what is this, man?
Yeah.
And I think about how many people who, yeah, the product, it just has to be perfect. It can't be this thing with flaws that maybe is more interesting.
It's, and I, I'm definitely I work really hard at getting things perfect. I mean, once I know what my intended product is, even if I got there by chance, once I get to that point, I am, like, in my recording processes, I am just, I get obsessive. And that, I feel like that's a different, for bad or for worse, I just get obsessive about it. So you're right, there's a moment of working on the perfection, but there's, like, a time for that. And, you know, there's a time for getting your cheese fries just right.
And, yes.
And you have to hope that, you know, there, people care about the cheese fries they're delivering to you. You know, you have to hope that they approached it with a sense of quality and understanding that I'm going to make the best potato, cover it with the best cheese, I'm going to cook it just right, and I'm going to present it to the guy with happiness and make sure he has a great day and enjoys it. Mm-hmm. But all of those levels, you know, you hope that someone does that. If you expect it, you're setting yourself up for a horrible failure.
Yes.
When it comes to cheese fries.
Yes, well, and but I think though it's also, and I've been thinking about this a lot, thinking about, like, you know, the environmentalist Bill McKibben said once, you know, you think about it, we live the way we normal North Americans, first worlders, global northers, however you want to call it, live like at least 90% of the people who on the planet right now, and unlike probably 99% of the people who've ever lived, and it does all this weird stuff for us. And you think about, like, maybe what, you know, in terms of, if you want to talk evolutionary biology or whatever, as some people do, kind of what we're, quote, hardwired for, and what the human species is about and how the human species lived, it was more about, is there food today?
Yeah.
Is there going to be food today? Yeah. I wonder if today will be a food day, you know, as opposed to the fucking cheese fries. Or remember that Burger King commercial where the people ordered Whoppers? It was like a hidden camera thing, and they got Wendy's burgers. And no, people flipped out. That was a moment in my life where I was like, "Wow, we're out of control."
Wait, was it a burger? Was it a commercial for Burger King?
It was a commercial for Burger King.
That's sneaky on their part.
And they,
because, like, if you want a Burger King burger and someone gives you something that's not that, you're gonna be like, "What the fuck did you just give me?"
Yeah. Well, there was one. The
no matter what
else, the logo, they had the logo, the Burger King logo, and this guy, just the voiceover, "I want a Whopper!" And I mean, it was like aggressive, like, "I'm going to kick your motherfucking ass if you don't get me that Whopper that I just ordered." And I just thought, holy shit. Yeah. Like, that's, and that's almost was like the company showing off.
Yeah.
Look what we did to you.
Yeah.
We set these Whopper expectations up. And if you don't get it, you're ruined. Yeah. It's almost like the dealer is saying, "Yeah, no, we're out.
Yeah,
no more smack for you, Mister."
Yeah, man.
Ooh,
that's so rude. That is such. I'm really fascinated by advertising, and that is like a false positive in my mind. Because it's like, if you gave that guy who wanted the Whopper, if you gave him a fucking steak, that was brilliant. You would still get a sense of shock out of him, and a sense of disbelief, and a sense of like, whoa, you're screwing with me. Even if he liked the steak.
Yeah.
So he would be like, he would felt screwed with. And that is, that makes him look like he dislikes Wendy's, but in fact, he doesn't like being screwed with.
Because
no one does. No one likes being screwed. No, if you were like, hey, we're going to give you a Wendy's burger for free, you just came to Burger King, he might still be like, you know, I want the Whopper.
Yeah.
Okay, so I have an idea for this improv thing.
Okay.
Should I improvise my song of the day?
Sure.
Okay, I'm going to get my ukulele out.
Oh, you're going to get your ukulele
out? I don't have to do it immediately, but I'm prepared for whenever you say go.
Okay, well, whenever the spirit moves you. Because I think then the thing is, too, is, okay, so externally, the Whopper's fucked up, the cheese fries are fucked up, the whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But I think also, what about internally, knowing what you're doing is good? Because I think there's that internal eye of, you talk about, okay, process, that then there's the product. How do you know, though, what you're doing? And I think that's something every creative person struggles with, unless they're a total egomaniac.
Right.
Because we've also always seen egomaniacs who, like, I can't say the name of the person,
okay, because
this is a local podcast, and I'm a local person, and Pittsburgh's not really a big town. But there is someone who performed, a couple artists who performed in Pittsburgh, and one in particular that I'm mentally thinking of, that is so serious, and so, like, I am a singer-songwriter, performer, I have a band, I do shows, this is a thing that's happening, but is hilariously incompetent.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to the point where the first time I saw this individual perform, I was like, fuck is this? And I was kind of like, you know what I mean? Like, oh my God, this guy thinks he's freaking, he thinks he's remaking Bruce Springsteen, Born to Run.
Right.
Like, this is the next generation of it or something. And it's really bad. And it was kind of funny at first, and then it stopped being funny.
Uh-huh.
Like, it became that feeling, if you've ever, like, seen a deer that's been hit by a car and the one leg doesn't work and it's still hopping around.
God.
That feeling of, like, empathy and pity, and you're just like, oh, dude, you need a hug. And then the thing is, I've actually met this person several times now, and I've encountered him at shows and said hi to him and talked to him.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like, but, you know, you just want to kind of, like, give him that, you know, grab the back there and, like, listen.
Yeah.
We need to talk.
Well, it sounds
like... We need to talk about what you're doing, but he's totally in love with it, but it's hilariously incompetent.
Mm-hmm.
And there's always that feeling, I think, you know, and I know that, you know, being an academic and, like, being in grad school and going to conferences, there's that weird competitiveness, or you're doing something that other people are also doing and thinking, well, where do I fit in here? That, yeah, there are those moments where people are just totally wrong or totally say something really stupid or do something really stupid, and you think to yourself, oh my God, that's not going to be me, is it? I'm going to get sick and die one day, but at least I'm not going to look like that while I'm still alive. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That moment of, like, pity and fear and humiliation.
Well, it's interesting to me that when you first started talking about this person, the first thing you said was he was serious.
Very serious.
And I think, like, and you imagine if he wasn't that serious about it. Meaning that, not that he didn't mean it was important to him, but that he was not so serious about it being good. It was more like, I'm having fun with everything I do.
Yeah, yeah.
It would change everything.
That would change so much, and we could maybe have fun too.
Mm-hmm.
Or if the idea that maybe the person is incapable of maybe laughing at themselves, or incapable of stepping outside of themselves for a moment, you know, this person I don't think can do that.
Yeah. It's important. And, oh my gosh, I would go crazy if I couldn't step outside myself and laugh at myself, because I'm an idiot.
Yeah, I know the feeling. I
thought you were going to say, I know that.
No, you're right.
It's fucking, it's great. Like, I do the stupidest things, and I have regrets and all kinds of stuff, but, you know, it's not like I tried to do bad. I just sometimes I ended up doing something really stupid.
It seemed like a good, and the willingness that it seemed like a good idea at the time.
Yeah.
And my past and my history, and I hope I never let go of that. And you know, Danelle will listen to this podcast at some point and go, oh, Jesus Christ. You know, because my past, my history is, well, it seemed like a good idea at the time. You know, let's do this, man. Let's buy that car. Let's move here. Let's take that job. Let's try to build that, paint that wall that color. Let's go this way. Mm-hmm. You know, all of those things, I like to think I'm still willing to do that, even mm-hmm. though it's going to be a horrible mess. Or I'll do something really stupidly ambitious. Yeah. It'll just ruin the next 6 months of my life, or whatever, or the next 10 years, or whatever. Like grad school, that's an idea I can do. I'll be a professor, you know, and it's right. it mixed results in the last 10 years on that. Let's do a podcast, you know, whatever, the willingness to fail. And that's one of these, I want to be damn kids. Yeah. But I think sometimes that tyranny of perfection is really stuck in the minds of maybe young people who, yeah, maybe haven't gone through their awful 20s and haven't gone to the fuck it stage yet.
Yeah.
Where it's like, but if I try this and it fails, mm-hmm. you know. I mean, that's a lot of the writing advice that I give students, especially honors students who are really good writers.
Yeah.
Well, what would happen if I did this? Would it work? Mm-hmm. And I'd be like, I don't know, maybe you should just try it.
Yeah.
Maybe just write a draft and see what happens.
And what would be so bad if it didn't work?
And what would be so bad? Yeah. Well, I also look at, again, those damn kids, those millennials or whatever, yeah. you know. And they're all good people, and I get really pissed if anybody does a story like, oh, they're the most narcissistic, shitty generation ever.
Yeah.
That's something that pisses me off. Like, you've never worked with these people. You've never, you don't even know your own kids if that's where they are. You don't fucking get it, you old piece of shit. You know, there's complicated things, and there's things that I do worry about with them.
Sure.
But one of them is that the idea of, you know, there's playing to win, and I think there's also playing not to lose.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea if you have, what happens if you have the perfect undefeated season?
Mm-hmm.
If you have a 4.0 or whatever the mark is of you're perfect and virginal and pure and mm-hmm. good, and you've never fucked up and you never lost, and there's nothing on your permanent record. You know, you had no unexcused absences in kindergarten or anything like that. Nothing has gone wrong to this point. How that weighs on a lot of young people,
mm-hmm.
you know, that, oh, yeah. I can't take a risk. I can't make this decision. I can't try something because if it doesn't work, I either hit my limit or the undefeated season's over.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something I think our culture has done to them. It's not like, oh, I'm just going to be a dick and do this. No, it's our culture has put all that shit on them.
Mm-hmm.
And it does, I think, stifle them. It is maybe a barrier to keep them from like enjoying their lives or being creative or having fun mm-hmm. in some cases because if I fuck up, man, this is it.
Yeah.
It's no tolerance, you know. If I point that chicken finger like a gun mm-hmm. in the cafeteria, I will get suspended.
Yeah.
And living with that kind of pressure, you know.
Yeah. That improv element of improve yourself, no. like that totally. I'm just bringing it back, but
yes.
But that, you know, it's that's totally like I love watching improv comedy.
Yeah.
I don't see it all the time, but when I do, I love it. And of course, there are people that are quote unquote better at it.
Yeah.
But even the bad groups or the people that aren't that good at it and my benchmark of being good at it is, am I laughing?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
if I'm not laughing, I still can't fault them because they are improvising.
Yeah.
They're like, maybe they had an off night. Maybe they're not comfortable with improvising yet.
Or the universe hasn't lined up yet. Yeah, or their chemistry with the other person.
So, but they're improv, it's like, it's that, and they are getting, by doing it, they're getting better, and by, but they have to do it to get better at it, and I think that's kind of why I started that project, and finally just freaking did it, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which, maybe speaking of freaking Should doing
do
it, it?
All right.
I think, is it,
all right,
is
it's
it
time the, to, it's time to do it.
It's time.
So
set up your gear.
So I'm just making a little recording so I can post it on my website. Just while my phone, but so here we go. I've never done this in front of anyone, so we will find out. spent my morning talking to a Yeti. Dog under my feet, thinking about spaghetti. I should have been talking about other things. I should have been talking about being king. But I spent my morning talking to a Yeti. When I grow up, I want to learn to lose. Instead of playing to win, I want to walk till there are holes in my shoes. Should have spent my time doing something else. But when I wake up, I want to learn to lose. Let me lose my face. I'm gonna spend tomorrow talking to a Yeti. Gonna spend tomorrow learning how to lose. Maybe I should spend my time doing something else. Gonna walk a mile till there's holes in my shoes. And I'm done.
Woo! Wow, that's wow. That was the thing that you did.
That was the thing that I did. I don't know what I like. It's interesting because I think of the product somewhat. Like, mm-hmm. I know that I don't, in order to make it a cohesive moment, mm-hmm. I have to remember to listen to what I already said and think forward, but not lose where I've been.
Yeah.
So that's why, like, it felt like right to bring back the Yeti thing.
Yeah.
Because I was getting a little, and I want, and these are like 3-minute experiments.
Yes.
So they're,
yes. Should we explain the reference?
We could. I think we should.
Yes.
Because it helps understand where we're at.
Yes. So the Yeti is the brand name or the model name of the microphone that we use.
Yes.
I use to record the podcast.
The Blue Mic Company, which is
the
a great
Blue Mic Company, and the Yeti, and
the Yeti.
Yes.
It's a great mic.
Yes, and so it allows people to hear my voice, which sounds like mm-hmm. bagpipes on autotune in the highest possible fidelity.
Yeah.
That $98 will allow. Yes. Yeah.
And I think, just thinking about what just happened for me, I have to let go of the weird chord. There's like, the melody was working one way in the chords. I was playing like chords that didn't fit the melody. And it was kind of like my fingers were doing something that, but at this point, engaging the part of my brain that does the music is hard to do while I'm engaging the part of my brain that does the lyrics and the flow of the music. Instead of, like, I can't think of pitch very well at this point.
Yeah.
While I'm doing that. It's just the whole process is fascinating to me.
Yeah. I think, too, though, in some ways, too, is also practices is something, as you keep going, you'll be able to master all of those things.
Hopefully.
And then suddenly, like, the songs are just going to come out. Which I think is also maybe part of, you know, that 30 thing or that being willing to play, is that then suddenly you get really fucking good at something
mm-hmm.
to the point where maybe it's not effortless, but it seems that way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I love Nick Cave, and the thing that I actually love about that man the most is I read an interview with him, and he said about how he has an office in London, mm-hmm. where he lives. That's not at his house. He rented a room somewhere. And in that office is a typewriter, a coffee maker, and a piano.
Nice.
And he goes, he gets there around 9 in the morning. He gets up, shaves, does his commute, gets there, and it's like, all right, 9 a.m., so I got the play going.
Yeah.
Probably need to be another Bad Seeds Records that year. What's the schedule look like? You know, and he takes a lunch break, and he comes home around 5.
You got to clock in, man.
Got to clock in. And I was just like, damn.
Yeah.
And you think about, and I remember the first time I heard that, like, kind of harder, louder band that he had called Grinder Man, and the song Worm Tamer. And it just seemed like, the first time I heard that song, I was like, this is dangerous and scary. And I thought I was too cynical in my 30s to be scared by music before. And it was so like, oh my God, I should really not be listening. These are bad people. And they're talking about scary things. And I was just like, God damn, this guy's in his 50s and he can pull that out of his ass.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing.
It's amazing.
And it's because he does that every day, where he just boom, 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 boom on the typewriter or whatever, or ding, ding, ding on the keys, and just like, all right, let's make some songs.
I am so getting that out of this project because it is a commitment to myself to do it, but it's a short commitment. I mean, you heard it. That was 3 minutes, and whatever comes out, but it keeps my brain involved in this on a regular basis. And one thing I would like to do with myself musically is to be able to give at least 3 hours in the morning to this kind of work, like to maybe improv a song, to maybe begin to compose and write and perfect a song, and then just to do the non-musical music business stuff.
Yeah.
Like that. So like, it's the regular every day as much as possible, and this really is a baby step because it's so short, but it's an easy commitment.
Yeah,
and but I love it.
Yeah, I remember I was at an academic conference. I'm an English professor, you know, an academic conference where Donald Hall, and he was just about to become the U.S. Poet Laureate, was speaking, and he said that his day is he gets up at 6, rolls into his home office, and works on poems till noon.
Yeah,
and then it's time to eat, and then do whatever the hell he's got to, hell else he's got to do that day. And then he said it also, and he's very meticulous, which in a personal level has, I think, been really bad for him after his wife passed away, because he holds on to stuff. And he wrote, like, Jane Kenyon passed away 7 or 8 years before. When he was talking about the conference, you would think it happened yesterday.
Wow.
And he wrote all these books. I mean, The Painted Beth, The Painted Bed, and Without, and there's this poem called Death Work, and it's just like, holy fuck, you know. It takes him a year to write a poem, he said.
Wow.
It takes him a year, and I was like, holy shit, I've been doing this totally wrong. You know, because I was like, I'm going to write it, and it's going to be done.
Yeah.
And I'm going to do it today, and I realized, no, in a year. And then he said, and it's never done. And there's stuff that he's written that's anthologized that he still, when he goes around and speaks at colleges, his readers' copies of his published anthologized poems have corrections in them that, oh, no, there actually should have been a comma there.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean? And the willingness that it's still alive, even though it's been out there in front of other people.
Yeah.
Which I think is amazing.
It is good. It is good. It's very good.
Yeah.
Because those like preserving it in any form, book, recording, like whatever, like setting it down is like, we think of it as permanent, but it's so not. It's just one small life of that.
Yeah, that thing. Art. And that really liberated me. When I heard him say that, I was like, oh, well, shit.
Yeah, you could take this podcast and just add a flanger effect to the whole thing.
Yeah,
why not?
I could. Or
I don't think you should, but you could.
You know, maybe I should. I think there might be an auto-tune effect in. Yes.
You could do it. I'll do that while you talk.
Yes, or you know, do the This American Life thing and just get, you know, put like steal a Rachel's album and just be like, no one's going to know what this is. It's too obscure. And then play it in the background or Godspeed You Black Emperor or something and just put it in the background and there'll be mood music, you know. Though I will say for me, that would be too much. That would be too serious.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, you know, I'm going to mix this. We're going to try compression on this one.
We are.
Yes, we are. But my editing and posting this takes 5 minutes. The actual thing that not is the work the computer does, but the, okay, cut it there, yeah. and there's what the theme music is, and line that track up, that's mm-hmm. 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And if I did anything else, or for me with Crap Cam, mm-hmm. with Crap Cam, I made the decision very odd, I'm not going to come up with witty titles.
Right.
Because I know I'm going to sit at the keyboard and agonize it and lose 15 minutes of my day, A. And then B, I'm going to post shit because, oh, I got to get to the bank. And then I'm going to drive my car and be like, fuck, that's what I should have called it. Yeah. Fuck. So yeah. it's just an alphanumeric code that
means more or less,
nothing.
With this songs, I more or less call them the first line of the like, that's sort of what I've committed to. Unless a title becomes so obvious.
Yeah.
But so this one will be called Improv Song Number 17, I Spent My Morning Talking to a Yeti.
Nice.
So, you know, nice. There you go.
And where can folks find that again? And where can they listen to that song and not have to listen to this whole damn podcast?
They can listen to it at soundcloud.com/spifftunes, yes. S-P-I-F-F, tunes. And that will also be spifftunes.com or spiffweekend.com should lead them to it as well. At the time of this podcast, not all of that stuff is in place, but hopefully by the time it's aired, quote-unquote aired, they'll be able to find it.
Oh, I was going to do that this afternoon.
SoundCloud is totally...
SoundCloud will be ready to go.
Yeah.
And what I'll do is I'll put the link for spifftunes.com.
And it'll only work when it works.
And it'll work when it works?
Yeah.
Press your luck.
Yeah,
all right. You feel lucky today? Click on it.
But the SoundCloud's definitely happening.
SoundCloud's happening, definitely. And we'll plug some more stuff in a minute, but it's time now, finally, for the bottom five.
Okay.
A series of questions not related to our main topic that are of a surrealistic and or philosophical nature. Are you ready for that?
I'm trying to be.
All right. Question one. It's not really a question. It's a prompt. Tell me a happy but somewhat unremarkable memory of your childhood. A happy but somewhat unremarkable. So no, oh, then there was that time we went to Disney World.
Right. Yeah.
But it was just a good day in your life.
You know what? I think I'm thinking of just fun times. I used to, underneath the back deck porch, it was like a first floor deck, so you know, you're not supposed to be underneath it, but you can get under there if you're a kid, especially. I would get down there and there were some old bricks, and I built a captain's chair, sort of, out of the bricks. I made a sort of a lounger, and I would pretend it was kind of a spaceship chair. I thought, you know, actually, even though I never played Star Trek, I loved the idea of that captain's chair he had. Yes. And so I would just sit there and be like, I'm running this shit. Yeah. and that was that was good for me.
That sounds like fun.
Yeah.
Question two, what's the strangest item you have eaten and or found in your stool? You don't have to, it doesn't have to be an and I found this later, it could have been a, what the fuck was that?
Can I tell you a funny story?
Hopefully, it's a podcast.
A girl I know took a poop, and she, and on the toilet paper, when she looked at it, there was something. And she thought it was like a piece of rice, but she was totally enthralled by it. So she actually picked it out and looked at it. And then, and by having it in her hands, squeezed it and didn't realize that it was actually a piece of citrus. And when she squeezed it, it exploded into her face.
Oh!
So that's just this. And she was so.
Oh my God.
What a horrible story.
But that is the worst thing I've ever heard in my entire life.
I've eaten raw horse meat. That was a pretty interesting one, like horse tartare. I had that.
Wow.
So that would be I had that in France, and the guy we bought the horse meat from was like, "This is high quality stuff, and you won't do yourself wrong by mixing a little oil and spices with it and just having it." And so we had a little bit of that, and then we made spaghetti and horse balls.
Oh, Jesus, spaghetti!
Shout out to Elisa in France.
Woo. Okay, question three. Again, this is a prompt. These aren't questions.
Sure.
Name an item from your childhood that you lost or got rid of that you most wish you could get back.
I was going to make a joke. like my virginity. What did I lose in childhood that an item? Wow. Oh, you know what was pretty cool? That album that we had, that family record vinyl that we had, that was the music from Close Encounters of the Third Kind. That was pretty freaking sweet.
That was pretty sweet.
I enjoyed that over and over
again. Can I tell you, I own that.
You own
it's
it now?
Upstairs.
It was
now,
so cool.
Now, did you also get the version with it that had the one-sided 7-inch? That was the disco remix?
No.
Oh, okay.
No. Yeah, but I now feel...
Sorry.
Sorry. I feel terrible about it. No, that was just such an enjoyable...
Thing.
We had a whole family routine to it.
Yes.
It was pretty fun.
Yes, yeah. But not the disco remix 7-inch.
Not the disco remix
7-inch. One-sided disco remix 7-inch.
God.
Got that. All right, question 4. And this is a genuine question.
All right.
What is one pop culture text or personal reference you wish more people did or knew about? A thing that just more people were into that means a lot to you that you would just, if you could just be that crazy guy that just shakes people and grabs them on their shoulders, fucking listen to this!
Yeah,
I know
exactly thing. What it is.
Okay.
It's the joy that is old radio. Old radio drama and comedy and stuff.
Oh.
It is like a wealth of really cool things. I mean, it's dated, but there are some really like the podcast thing is I think is making the idea a comeback. There's like Super Ego is something that exists and is funny, and there's a show called The Thrilling Adventure Hour, which is like a new time podcast in old time style.
Uh-huh.
I don't love all of it, but I really like one of their things, which is I can't even remember what it's called, but I love it. So there's a new thing sort of coming. It feels like there's this new medium, podcasting, that's been around for a while, that people can really do whatever they want with. But that old radio stuff is just great. Just
that
great.
That is great, yeah. Ready for the last one?
I think so.
Question 5. What would your idea of purgatory be like?
This is like not bad, not good kind of waiting room.
Yes.
Place. My idea of purgatory?
Yes. Not heaven, not hell. But you kind of fucked up.
You know what it would be? This is what first comes to mind without too much thought. It would be sitting, being in, like a sort of a blank room with like a guitar and no one to share it with but myself, like I think there's something about giving the music away that is, so I get joy playing for myself, but if I knew I could never give it to anyone, I would be pretty miserable. But not terribly miserable, because I'd get to play music.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It would be like, it would just be like a crotch 22.
Yeah. Yes. And though, I guess, though, if you want to go Twilight Zone-y with it, it would turn into hell if you broke the E string.
Right. Oh, God.
That would be you're the right. Bing. Oh, fuck.
Yeah,
you. The
you're
Burgess
right.
Meredith. It was time now.
That's funny. You're right. That would suddenly turn into hell.
Yeah. There's no guitar center in purgatory. There's no or maybe there is guitar center.
Maybe guitar center is purgatory.
Or it's hell. Yeah. I Adam, and I don't think I recorded it when I had him on for episode 6. He said that guitar center gives him anxiety.
Oh, man.
Because you walk in there and there's always somebody playing bad AC/DC.
Yeah.
Like, no matter what time of day.
It's true.
That's what it is.
It's totally true.
Yes.
It's totally true.
All right, so it's time for the promo part. So what do you got going on? So, SoundCloud /SpiffTunes.
Mm-hmm.
SpiffTunes.com.
Mm-hmm.
SpiffWeGan.com.
Yes.
And we should probably spell that.
SpiffWeGand.
.com. And what else you got going on this summer, this year? It's early in the summer 2013.
Yeah.
Though this will live forever in a podcast.
I don't feel like I have a lot to... I mean, those things that you mentioned are all just where people should see what I'm up to lately. I don't have any big projects other than this newfound joy in improvising a song every day, yeah. and trying to get better at the music business thing. Other than that, I have nothing going on. I don't have any tours to promote or anything like that. Oh, they should come see me in New York on the 18th of June. This is 2013 right now. Mm-hmm. So they should come see me on June 18th at a place, a newish place in Brooklyn called The Cool Pony. I'm playing at 10 o'clock.
Okay.
That's the gig they should come see.
All right. Yeah. Let's all get in the car and go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, man. Thanks, all right. Matt.
I think that's about it. Our next episode will eventually happen, and it will be about something. Our homepage, where you can find old episodes and new episodes, is GonnaDiePodcast.com. We're also on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter at GonnaDiePodcast. And We're All Gonna Die is on Facebook and the Google Plus. Thanks to Brett Zorich, as always, for the lovely theme music. Later, meets.